The world is a complex place full of hypocrisy and contradiction. Systems that atrophy around us can no longer be relied on and trusted. Our leaders are fallen figures and our poets are all mute. But football is nice. Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Football is Nice with me, Russell Brand. Today I've dispatched with Hull's favourite son, Gareth Roy, in favour of British entrepreneur, broadcaster, author, iconoclast and disruptor, Simon Jordan, who by the age of 32 had built a company from nothing. He'd made it from nothing. He sold it for $95 million, bought Crystal Palace Football Club, which is a type of football team almost in London. He's the best-selling author of Be Careful What You Wish For, now co-hosts The Daily Show on Talk Sport in the UK, which I've had the great privilege of appearing on, where his opinions, views, willingness to confront the establishment and ordinary platitudinous orthodoxy has bought him legions of fans, many people calling him a kind of peroxide paxman, the Tucker Carlson of sport. Please welcome to Football is Nice live on Rumble. If you're a member of Locals, press the red button right now. You can join us on Locals and you can pose questions to Simon Jordan. It's Simon Jordan. Hello.
$95 million.
Is that what it was that you sold your business for?
No, it was about $136 million at the time.
Oh, yeah, well done.
What, so it was a little bit better than that.
Was it tech?
It was mobile telephony. So I was the reasons why people are sitting there gawping at their phones and doing nothing else besides sitting in their mum's bedrooms with their pants around their ankles, sending out rude messages over cyber optics is because of people like me. As I voyaged out here into the country, I saw a little signpost saying medieval jousting. I assume that's not a metaphor from what I'm about to experience.
We're so deeply ensconced in rural Britain that medieval jousting is the frontier of entertainment here, the apex. That's what we do out in the...
It's an interesting little setup. As I came wandering up here and saw the studio, I thought it was...
You know, get a bit more on mic.
A little bit like I expected sort of Felicity Kendall to come bowling out from the good life and get mugged by Richard Briers on the way in.
You could get mugged by a cosy sitcom.
It's like a TARDIS, isn't it? It's much bigger on the inside.
Yeah, that's right.
Indeed.
Like my mind, like your vocabulary.
Doctor Who character you are.
There you are. I've got a little bit of that about me. Simon, I'm really excited to talk to you.
Nice to be here, mate. Thank you for coming into our show the other day, so I'm very glad to reciprocate.
It went pretty well, didn't it?
You were brilliant.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much. What I enjoy about our...
You were loved.
Loved, actually.
People loved you.
Which ain't... That's a rare treat, because I've always been someone who divides opinions. I've accepted that, and as part of...
Because if you're dividing opinions, it means you're moving across echo chambers, moving into different spaces where people can relate or disagree in equal measure. I think that's good. People that are successful tend to be a little bit Marmites.
Yeah. Marmite, for those of you watching this in the United States of America, is a disgusting yeast-based paste that people...
That you get to smear.
Smear. I can't think even of a US equivalent of Marmite, but certainly it's a
Vegemite
divisive
in Australia.
Culture.
Vegemite in Australia.
Yeah, like America, they care about Australia even less than they care. There was a brief moment with Paul Hogan, who you're
indeed
not dissimilar to,
Crocodile
let's face
Dundee.
It.
In what basis? Because once upon a time, I had the desire to make myself look like an Adonis in blonde.
Do you know what I
it's
thought?
It's grey now.
I was thinking about this from you. A man from ordinary origins.
Indeed.
Ridiculous haircut when you first burst onto the scene. Autodidact, I assume. Ridiculous haircut. It's like looking in a mirror. Me, the Dionysian. You, the Apolline. Nevertheless, we're in some ways of similar people.
I pushed back against conventional wisdom. I had a mother that was a hairdresser at Vidal Sassoon who said to me, "The fuck are you doing that for?" And I thought, no, I will not go down that route. I shall do precisely what I want.
Because that
and
was it, a Larry haircut.
Well, I mean, it was a bob. And it was a moment in time.
It certainly was. You really captured the spirit of the... Was it the 90s?
Yeah, well, no, it was the early 2000s, thank you.
But look
it was,
at that,
it was also,
Simon.
Yeah, that was then.
You look like a scarecrow with an ambition to model.
Do you think so?
Yeah, specifically Wurzel Gummidge.
Do you think I look like the Crow-Man out of Wurzel Gummidge? Yes,
somewhat.
Absolutely. Or, a cross between Catweasel, which the American audience will get no relevance to.
I know, with Catweasel
and
Wurzel
Gummidge.
TV.
But you can imagine rocking into the ballrooms of Premier League football clubs with the average age of a chairman being about 65, and that comes wandering through the door. It must have been a wonderful greeting that I got.
Because you would have been talking to, like, sort of Ken Bates.
Yeah, I would. Yeah.
It was an anomalous time. This, since you've been involved in the game, it's metastasized into a global corporate entity. It's no longer figures like Jack Walker, who once owned
Blackburn.
A global
entertainment business. I don't know about a global corporate entity, but a global entertainment opportunity, which will then maybe morph, as you suggest.
Why do you think that is an important distinction?
Because I think that your propensity to want to make everything about some corporate elitism isn't necessarily as prevalent in this football as it is in other sectors. But there is an element of it, and we can perhaps kick that around in our discussions, but I'm not entirely sure that your little revolution that you want to go on sometimes is necessarily as prevalent in football as you'd like it to be.
Where do you think the game is heading when we have more and more state ownership or de facto state ownerships of top flight clubs? Do you not think that it is precisely the type of corporate gigantism that I'm describing elsewhere, particularly when contrasted to a time where a kid from South London with nothing but a blonde bob and a dream march into Selhurst Road
and a kind word
and start telling Mark Bright what to do.
I
mean, it's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the days of the cook, the candlestick maker, the baker owning football clubs are probably long gone. But that's the world that we wanted to create. Football was no different from any other parts of society that's susceptible to globalism and globalisation and the opportunities that it brings, because it's such a hook, a conduit, an anchor for so many different things that, as much as I don't like it, and the idea of nation states, the subterfuge of people suggesting that the acquisitions of clubs like Newcastle United aren't nation states because they've got sovereign wealth funds that ultimately fund nation states, needs to be debated. But if you look at recent terms, if you look in America, they don't allow that sort of acquisition of what people would consider to be societal and community assets, i.e. sports clubs. That's not allowed. That's not tolerated. It seems to be the case in Europe that we have a different attitude towards it. But if you look at recent times, albeit I think it's dressed up in, and again, subterfuge, the Premier League, the English Premier League, have suggested now that they're not going to allow nation-state ownership, which is a bit like, you know, shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, because it's already there and it's already very prevalent. And how they're going to stop it, because without being overly melodramatic, you've got a situation where nation states are using vehicles to buy football clubs and then able to convince the village idiots posing as people that are running the Premier League because it suits them, because they'd rather have Middle Eastern money in the Premier League than perhaps in the Italian league or the Spanish league or the German leagues, because that money will develop their leagues faster. And then they've been convinced, for example, the PIF fund is not a nation state. It's a separate entity. There's a arm's length relationship between Mohammed bin Salman, who's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, and this sovereign wealth fund whose sole purpose in life is to advance the financial benefits for the nation, is not a nation state. Yet you find out in another realm, in America, that LIV Golf, which is funded by PIF, has made the case that it is a nation state.
Yeah,
so it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of things I want to pick up on, Simon, and what you've said, mate. Firstly, the PIF have taken over four domestic league clubs over there in Saudi Arabia, making them sort of national assets. You'll be aware of that.
But that's how they work, don't they?
Is it, mate?
And the moment a business in Saudi Arabia becomes successful, what happens is the state requisitions it.
I see.
That's how they work.
And with the acquisition, the de facto acquisition of a club like Newcastle, and with the, you know, the potential for United to become owned perhaps in a comparable way by Qatar, with City already owned by Abu Dhabi. And this, for me, isn't about the geographic location of the, you know, the fact that they're all Middle Eastern entities, because I wonder what the distinction is between state ownership and corporate ownership when it's a gigantic corporation like, you know, FSG or comparable like entities.
But one has a commercial agenda, the other has an influence agenda. And one is slightly more different than the other, because if you're looking at the Middle Eastern guys, and neither one of us are sitting here from a xenophobic position, we're just questioning the validity and the motivation and the methodology being deployed. And so you look at someone like the Middle, and I have no objection to anybody trying to advance their society, anybody being able to participate in anything like sport, because we don't have a God-given right in Europe or North America to suggest that we own sports and sports can't evolve. But when they're being used as a vehicle, some would say for sports washing, to legitimize their regimes through parts of the world that don't accept them, or, to go to your point, to advance the industrial opportunity because they want to turn away from having to be sort of funded by the only thing they can be funded by, which is underneath the sand, which is oil, and turn it into a hub or a commercial vehicle for different opportunities. So that goes to your narrative about the fact there's a corporate agenda behind it rather than just an acceptance of embracing a different opportunity for a different part of the world to compete.
And whilst it's clear from your description that one of those propositions is potentially more nefarious and more vast, my perspective is a romantic one, Simon, and it's based on this is something I really would value your opinion on. It's the idea that somehow football still encompasses a sense of deep community connection, that people feel like they own their football clubs, that they love their football clubs, and that football can present us with these moments of incredible romance, whether it's something as potentially trivial but yet beautiful as David Moyes giving his medal to his father after West Ham won the most important European Cup recently, becoming champions of Europe
of the Premier League in Europe,
most important of the trophies available. What I suppose I'm saying is that it feels to me that even though a Super League was mooted, then rebutted because of fan outrage a little while ago, that if we see this kind of corporatism continue, does it become inevitable that the globalisation of the game will eventually
breaks the links between community, community values.
And like that, the next step of that dislocation will become games being played elsewhere, franchises being moved around, as we see in the United States of America with their football team and hockey teams or whatever. And at what point did it stop being the thing that presumably motivated you? Because I bet for you, why did you buy Palace and not Millwall or Fulham? Presumably it's a romantic connection to your father.
My father played for them. I'd grown up 100 yards away from the stadium and it was the club that I wanted to own.
And also, Russell,
it's because I saw a commercial opportunity. Because, you know, nobody goes into football, no matter how philanthropic they feel about it, to lose money. There will always be an end game, whether it's your exit strategy that gets you back the money you've invested and maybe takes some money out of it for you. And if you've done well and everyone else has done well as a result of it and the club has prospered, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with people making money from football. No one seems to have a problem with football players or managers or agents getting paid a king's fortune. Anyone moots the idea that someone that actually owns a football club should get some money out of it. They should be flogged at dawn. But the notion that you're advancing is that we are beginning to move into a territory where you're taking away the grassroots and the values of a football club that was built from years gone past when the factory workers used to turn out at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and 3 o'clock kickoff times are put there to be able to meet the expectations of the people that wanted to watch football. And then you've got the other side of the argument, which is the romantic side against the reality of what fans actually want to see football become. They want to see the best players. They want to see the best way of watching it. They want to see the best stadia. They want to see all of these scenarios. So with that comes a cost. And then there's this sort of prostitution of the soul. What do you want? Do you want to have the earthy football club that Bob Lord once presided over in 1960s in Burnley when he was the town mill baron and everyone went to him with their cloth caps to watch the football team? Or do you want this wonderful, dynamic, gold dust orientated, 360 degrees, 7 day a week, 24 hour access to sport? America's different. I lived in America for 2 or 3 years and the tribalism, albeit exists, it's not steeped quite so much in the culture and society of Western Europe in terms of specifically England, where you've got a football club. A town often thrives and sometimes survives by the very nature of having a successful football club into it, because it reflects aspiration, it brings commerce in there, it brings people coming in to spend money in that town because their team's doing well or not doing so well, and obviously the knock-on effects of that have a diametrically opposed effect. But there is this balance. I've often thought, and I would disappear into your sort of romantic, saccharine, sentimental world, of we should have a blue, you know, the blue plaques that we have celebrating Grade 2 listed buildings above a football stadium, suggesting that these things need to be governed by a different set of parameters. But when you start flying players around the world in private jets to get their toenails clipped, and you start paying people £500,000 a week, the dynamics change. And it's about trying to manage the evolution alongside the aspiration, alongside the reality of what people see it to be.
I don't think anyone, you know, I'm sure some people would, but the argument I'm advancing is not that there's anything with enlightened self-interest young man acquiring Crystal Palace, both out of a sentimental attachment to the club and reverence, perhaps, for his father, love of the game, natural love of
also
football.
Also wanted to be successful. Wanted to be good in another field.
Exactly, though, Simon. There's nothing wrong.
That's egotistical. Anyone that buys football clubs often has an ego attached to it as well. You buy football clubs for credibility. You buy it for recognisability. If you're Roman Abramovich, you once bought it for the most expensive life insurance policy. But you do it for different reasons.
Yeah. If ego is part of the qualification,
you should have all of them. You should have all of them.
You should
own the entire Premier League.
So what I'm saying, right, is there a point where the convergence of these two ideas, one idealistic and about a love of the game and the basic way that the free market operates, turn a profit from a business, become so sort of capsized, so overtly metastasized that you can no longer discern the original community romantic connection? At what point, like we experienced during the COVID period where fans weren't present and the economic model still works, but does the idea logical model still work? That's where I'm trying to get to.
It did was because what you saw was this enormous rush to watch television and this enormous appreciation. Ironically, how important fans were, and the moment they get back in the grounds is how can we control them? Don't let them go on the pitches and celebrate with the players, and ultimately players should be distanced from actually even engaging with the fans. So there's this juxtapose of actually how football views what I consider to be the most valuable asset that it's got, which is the people to watch it.
Yeah. And that, in a sense, we don't watch it just passively. We participate in it. Mm. And the thing that I'm sort of circling around is, at what point does this process of sanitization that we see elsewhere in culture, commodification that we see elsewhere in culture, corporatization, where in the sense the product, you know, if we're going to call it that, no longer has its original value. At what point do we say, shouldn't we intervene? Because this is, we can see where this is heading. This is heading to a global Super League where games are played, in the state of the highest bidder, where, you know, don't matter if you're Luton or whatever top flight franchise you are, you can be uprooted and planted wherever. And what I suppose I still feel in football is it is a vehicle for community, is a vehicle for sort of a version of tribalism that's safe. It's a vehicle for romanticism, heroes, etc. But it's also a way of plotting the way that the culture is changing and in a way that I think requires regulation. And yet when we spoke before, you talk about the player, you know, salary caps, and I'll yield that. I'm not bothered in
You can't regulate emotional relationships, can you? You can't regulate the way people perceive the value that they attach to something which, you know, despite Bill Shankly's, you know, observations about football not being life and death, it's more important than that. People will engage with sport the way that they want to. And there's one thing you can't do is control that. The product itself and the uniqueness, certainly, of the English game is very different than any other part of the world, even other European countries.
Is it, you think?
Yeah, I do think so.
Napoli, though, when they're going all nuts with them ultras.
Yeah, okay. There's always exceptions that don't always prove the rule. But, I mean, in Europe, you'll get more of that relationship. You start to move. And, of course, in South America, where you've got absolute lunacy at times about the patronage. You've even got in Colombia, people got shot because they didn't perform in a World Cup.
So
we're taking it a little bit too far. But you look at the cynicism of certain things, like, you know, I have no dog in the fight with Manchester City. People turn around and say, if you criticise Man City, it's because you're jealous of them. I'm not jealous of Man City. I don't support Man City. I'm not envious of anybody, never have been. But I also believe that there's an approach to the way that football should work, that because it's a collective business. The trickle-down economics that we often hear about in other parts of the world that are supposed to benefit societies really don't ever work. But the trickle-down economics in football do affect it, because what you pay people and what people cost at the very top end up landing at the bottom, and the economics of football don't work that way. That's why there's an element of cynicism about the Man City model, because what they've done is precisely what you advocate for, which is recognising the community. So they've gone in and they've regenerated the community alongside the football club. The football club's been the hook, and they've spent lots of money in Moss Side and regenerated this and made valuable parts of the community feel more valid in terms of the investment into the structure, and everyone goes how wonderful that is. But the objective behind that is not because Sheikh Mansour wanted to wander around Moss Side. It's because there's a vehicle here which indeed gives you legitimacy and validity and builds the relationships that they want to have by utilising sports clubs. And I'm slightly troubled by that. I'm not as utopian as you. And I'm much more, I'm sort of like a Tom Berenger character out of Platoon. I don't need reality. I am reality. I see things for what they are in terms of, look, let's look at it. Let's look at the reality of what things can become, what things should become, and what they will become, and try and find a hybrid of the three.
Because I feel that the biggest obstacle, the only way to prevent this globalised model where it will impact the fans' emotional connections with clubs, because I think ultimately what will happen, and we witnessed a touch of this.
The fans where? Indigenous to the location, or this global audience that's now being brought around the world to see football in this country?
Because I would say a less cynical model would be to build grassroots clubs in all these various territories, so there is a geographical connection between the fans that
love the game.
Well,
tell me how that works then.
Well, I don't have.
You've got 92 clubs. You've got 92 clubs occupying a very small country, and you've got overpopulation in certain parts of the country in terms of football clubs. Most parts of the country are represented. You've got one example in 150 years of football, of a football club being geographically relocated. Half of that was my fault because I drop kicked them out of my stadium. Out you go, Wimbledon. Don't want you here anymore. And they became AFC Wimbledon and moved out and became AFC Wimbledon and Milton Keynes. But we've not got any other examples of it.
Hold on.
Your fear is that that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Well, you've got no basis for that fear.
Well, I haven't got a basis, because only 14 Premier League clubs would need to vote for something like that. And we're approaching that number where they're going to have comparable intentions.
Okay. Explain to me the logic of XYZ club moving from XYZ location to another one.
Money.
Okay. Well, give me an example of what that looks like.
What? Because there are these new emergent models, for example, it would have been unthinkable a little while ago for the MLS to participate in the funding of the Messi transfer in the way that they did. The league itself, commercial sponsors and the club come together to acquire a player because they all acknowledge that the benefits will be spread across the country. So as this model continues to evolve, capitalism doesn't go backwards. Globalism doesn't go backwards. It becomes more immersive. They'll have more commercial partners.
The MLS model isn't particularly working, is it?
Let me paint.
It's working for the owners, but it's not working for
sport. And that's the only people it needs to work for, is the owners. That's, what, in fact, the argument that I am trying to undergird here, Simon, is that if we came close to creating a Super League, it didn't work because the fans balked it. They're obviously not going to go away, as I've heard you say on the radio.
It didn't work because there wasn't enough money put up by JP Morgan.
But they'll refine it and they'll find ways
to
make it work.
But did you think there was anything wrong with that then?
I do, mate, because I think that what this is my...
Are you happy with your team playing in Europe?
Do you know what I think? This is where I think it should go. It should move. We should. This is set in a broader cultural framework. You're gonna have to let me explain this. Don't interrupt, because I'm interested in hearing from you. I'm only saying this stuff so as I can make sure. Like, I want you to understand the nuance of what I'm saying, so that I can get the nuance of your response. What I think should happen is that there should be ownership, fan ownership of clubs. In fact, this is a big political point that I've been mulling over for ages.
Like Germany.
I'll take you there. Beyond Germany, actually. If I was running politically, no, not if I was running, that's too dangerous. If someone was running politically, here's something I would suggest as part of their manifesto. As the Saudis have just renationalised those four clubs because they've become an asset, under our administration, we will renationalise all the 92 league clubs. Those assets will be seized and they will be owned not by the state but collectively by the community. Watford will be owned by Watford fans. Arsenal will be owned by Arsenal fans. Liverpool will own Liverpool fans. I told you it's
new. You can't renationalise.
Liverpool
you
will
mean
be
nationalize.
Owned by Liverpool fans. And it's going to be taken back by the state in the same way you could with municipal assets, and then collectively owned by the community. Vote for me. Now what have you got? Right. You've got a mighty marching movement of people that are willing to go on the streets when they're dissatisfied. It's a brilliant idea, Simon.
You mean
nationalise. Think beyond the money.
You mean nationalise, because it's never been nationalised before, so we wouldn't renationalise them. You'd be nationalising them for the first time.
Yeah, we'd be renationalising some other assets.
How would that funding model work for the football clubs?
What do you mean by the funding model?
Well, because you've got a situation now where the genie's out of the bottle. The economics of football at such a level, right, that ultimately fan ownership, which I don't have a particular problem with, besides the fact that it becomes too emotive, too visceral in its decision-making process, and it doesn't make much commercial sense.
You want emotion. You want it to be visceral.
Yeah, but you want it outside the boardroom.
I suppose this only works, but it's a paradigm shift, Simon. I can't sort of go, here's my spreadsheet.
It's a deluded shift, yeah.
It's not a deluded shift.
It is
this
a little bit.
What this is addressing
Puggled.
Is the fact that we have turned everything
deranged.
Into a commodity, and this is an attempt to redress that phenomena and reverse it. You own your football clubs. You own your electricity. You own your water works. We are rejecting this model. We are reversing it, and we are granting you, fans of Everton, you own Everton Football Club now. You run it democratically. Does that mean you're going to be able to pay players as much as you used to? Absolutely not. What's going to happen? There's going to be a seismic shift in the game.
I'm happy with that.
The world is going to alter, because that's really what we're sort of discussing. I want to break the framework. I don't want to operate within the existing framework.
In your reverse Davos mentality of the Great Reset, but going the alternative way with it, What you're suggesting
is... It's democratic. It's not Davos because it's voted for by the people. You can never get it through unless the people vote for
it. In the reverse is what I said to Davos, right?
So it's democratic. And there's nothing wrong with that.
In your view. Right?
And it's sodav.
So we look at it and say that you believe this is a global order, that every league will fall in order with this. The Spanish
it doesn't
do
matter. This is quite isolationist.
Well, it does,
this is
take because, back because all of a sudden your scabby little team won't be playing in Europe anymore because it won't be able to compete.
We
because
don't
all
want
the
them
other
anymore.
European
we
teams
would
be far more competitive. And not, so, so we'd have this wonderful model in the UK, which the guys on the bus with you would have this viewpoint that your sentiment has some validity to it. No one else in Europe would perform that, and then we'd be the sick man of European football on that basis.
Well, I can see where you might stand on an argument like Brexit based on some of the rhetoric.
No, I have a very open mind.
Well, this is just that. This is simply that. What this is suggesting is that in order to break down globalist models, you're going to have to take legislative and regulatory steps. Why not confront this at the most populist level possible?
Football.
Instead of going about it in things people don't really understand or care about or can't connect to, find ways that they actually connect, mobilise them there. Mobilise them where it matters. You own your community. Why do you care about football? Because of your father. Why do you care about football? Because of the feeling it gives you. Why should your football clubs be owned by conglomerates abroad just because of an economic model that doesn't serve you, that's never served you, that doesn't respect you, that wants you dumb and dead, all that stuff?
But you're saying that, right? You're saying it doesn't serve people. Yet you've got a league in this country, in England, that's the envy of every league around the world.
It's brilliant. The heroine's brilliant.
You've got fans. You've got momentarily, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
And I suppose owning a football club is a bit like taking drugs, isn't it? It takes all your money, gives you a headache, and wish you hadn't done it.
But the railings ain't suffered. You've still got lovely gnashes.
I'm all right,
and we've smacked you.
Don't
be in
compare
trouble.
My experiences to yours, right? this wasn't an intervention. I look at the scenario and say, well, what's broken so far? You're railing against the system and saying it needs to be fixed. But what is it that you think's broken? We are seeing fans. We're seeing attendances.
What do you think's broken? You're the one saying cap the payers. I think's broken is that we're losing the game. Although we're creating an entertaining product, we're losing the connection. We're losing the thing that's real about it. That's what I'm claiming.
Do you think so? I mean, do you think that the fans themselves, from what I see, are more engaged and more invested than they have been for some time?
We've got to invest. It's bloody expensive. The merch is expensive.
Well,
the people that built the game can't afford to get in the stadiums Simon.
In your corporate outlook of what the world is doing, or you're railing against it when they've got the Premier League establishing that the away fans will only pay £30 a ticket. So there is a valuation and a structure in place that tries to underpin.
Are you an individualistic? Well, you're from a normal working class background. What is the affinity you feel with that community? What do you feel about just basic arguments that people from that part of South London won't be able to eventually afford to attend games? They won't be able to participate except by watching Crystal Palace playing in, I don't know, somewhere in Malaysia for millions of dollars.
I'm not sure that's right.
You think it's going that way, don't you?
No, I think that the least amount of money generated inside a football club is by what people pay to get into it. The broadcasters are the ones that bring the revenue in, the corporate sponsors.
So the geography is sort of irrelevant in a global
to
game.
Some extent, yeah, to some extent. I'm not in the camp of wanting to see Premier League games being played in America. I understand why other leagues want to do that, because they need to do it because they can't keep up with the financial juggernaut that is the Premier League, which, by the way, hasn't even scratched the surface of the opportunity it can present.
For a broadcast, you mean?
Well, for broadcasting, yeah, because we've got a situation where you've got a product which is in demand. You've got a model that exists over here, which is a VOD platform in Netflix, which has got a market cap of $250 billion. And you've got and built its business primarily on other people's content. You've got the Premier League that could build the same model, reduce the cost of football to people by the very nature of the volumes it can achieve worldwide, and multiply its revenues by factors of 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. And then what you've got is you've got a product which is delivered to people when they want it, how they want it, where they want it, at a price they're prepared to consume, and everybody wins. Then it goes against my argument then, of course, that I want football to suddenly suppress the expenditure on not what you call the poor, hard done by footballers I'm targeting to get their wages brought down. I'm just trying to get substance into the game, and a game to be supported by its own merits rather than Daddy Warbucks pop in with an agenda, whether that be Simon Jordan 20 years ago because he made 100 million quid and wants to buy his local football club, or whether it be Sheikh Mansour because he has it for a different reason. It needs to be sustainability. And at this moment in time, we've got the Wild West. And that's why I have an admiration for the MLS model. But I also have a bit of disdain for it, because the MS model is a group of owners getting together, because I put a team in America. I put the first English team into America. We played out of Annapolis in Washington State. And I looked very carefully at MLS model. And to one part of my mind as an owner, yeah, get it. All the owners get together. We work out how we're going to make money. And then we work out everyone else is going to make money. And that has some resonance to it. The other side of it, it makes it the world that you're advocating for, which is it loses the competitivity of it. It loses the objectivity of it. And it makes it all about money. But it is there already, Russell.
Do you think
I may
so,
well
mate?
Be in the land of brand, but I'm still slightly commercial in my thinking.
I don't think there's anything wrong with the entrepreneurial spirit.
I think there's nothing wrong with capitalism either, but I think there's everything wrong with irresponsible capitalism.
Yeah, and I think that's where we are, and I think that we're going to see it play out in sport. I've got a question that's on a slightly different tack now, but I think you'll be well into it. With the success of Wrexham based around like Ryan Reynolds' acquisition and the way it's played out on Disney, and again, sort of tapping into the romance of the game, and I think any Wrexham fan would say it's like the best thing that's happened to them and they love it and all that kind of
stuff.
It's
a moment in time, isn't it?
It certainly is. But did you see the other day they were playing like in America against the ladies team and all that kind of thing? Do you know what it made me think of? Is that now Wrexham, because of, not because of the merit of their football club, although they've done very well getting into the league, but because of sort of the paraphernalia of fame and celebrity, they've entered into a new domain. Do you know what it made me think of? And I know you know an awful lot about boxing and you're a big boxing fan. It made me think of like 10, 20 years ago, like if you're fighting in Vegas, if you're showcased as an elite boxer, you've earned that on merit and you've got the scars to prove it. Well, now you've got the phenomena of Conor McGregor fighting Floyd Mayweather. You've got YouTube boxers fighting for millions, KSI and Logan Paul and all that stuff. Is there not a danger that this sort of almost the essence of sport, which is meritocracy, is being sort of eroded, that you can create these Frankenstein clubs, these entertainment products? It's not an attack on Wrexham. No. It's, in a sense, I'm coupling it with that trend. Like, because years ago, you wouldn't have got a couple of people that were unrecognisable in the context of the sport.
It's a clever deal, isn't it? It's a clever digital deal where they're using their reputations to enhance the opportunity and make a movie about it. That's what they're doing, really, aren't they? Netflix are going to fund them, I suspect, and they're going to build a television series out of it. And that will take them so far. And then when, you could watch Salford, you could watch The Class of 92 and all that went with that. And, of course, the stardust that goes with Beckham and Giggs and Scholes and Gary Neville and that mob and see that Salford were manufactured into a situation. But it doesn't alter the fact that the argument that you would make, which is the community that they represent, are delighted. They're thrilled that their football club is back on the map. Now, Ryan Reynolds and his mate will go so far, and when it eventually lands in their pockets, they've got to put their hands in their pockets to go through the gears, because meritocracy will still be the end game. Wrexham will be the movie of the week, right, for a period of time. And when it gets a bit tough in League One, if they ever get there, and you've got to start funding a football club properly, then that may run its course. But if West Ham, if Wrexham, comparison between Wrexham and West Ham, not a good one. If Wrexham were to find a different way of delivering an outcome, because whether we're in a digital age or whether they're using other aspects of the opportunity available to them to build a football club, still at the centre of it is a football club and a community. If that team were to go through the levels and get in the Premier League, it would be another story, a different strand of the football story that needs to evolve. We're in a generation now that consumes what it looks at and what it reads through things like this, mobile telephones. Once upon a time, you used to call the kitchen wall to speak to someone. You don't now, do you? Everything evolves. If you lose something when you're evolving, which is your argument, is the trade-off good enough? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that we've lost too much. I still think you've got massive engagement. I do media stuff where you're dealing with fans and their emotional investment on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And I don't see it lessening. I see it heightening. I also see the entitlement of fans heightening, which I'm not sure is a good thing.
And I wonder if it's like a sort of a frantic and fearful twitching corpse as the sense that this game is being corporatised and owned elsewhere dawns upon the sort of collective unconsciousness that something is rotten in Denmark. But I've got a few things I want to like flesh out. They're all starting to tie together a little bit now. Because say like when Wimbledon went through the leagues, FA Cup final, beat Liverpool, Culture Club versus the, crazy game.
Until I turfed them out of Stellars Park.
Yeah, all right. You keep mentioning that. You obviously want that followed up on. But my point is this, right?
Out they went.
Off they go. Dave Besson and your Loopy Barnett. Laurie Sanchez, you can fuck off.
Yeah, I'll teach you Harry Bessett to write me a letter to say, piss off, young Billy Whiz, or whatever he wrote to me.
Is that what he wrote?
Yeah, he wrote.
Because you're Billy Whiz?
Yeah, I fired...
get him out the door.
I fired Steve Coppell, and he wrote some article in a newspaper, and I said, do I really have to listen to these dinosaurs from the past? So he wrote me this
Evicted
letter...
Him.
No, his side that he used to manage, and he wrote me this letter saying, bollocks, H, you, Harry Whiz, should mind your own business. And I'm like, how can I not mind my business? It's my football club, it's my manager, I'll fire who I want. But there, on a tangent.
Gave the old Bob a little comb and then out the fucking door, tack it, tack that up.
As opposed to the Jesus of Nazareth look, yeah.
Like the Wrexham is what, like, you know, Wrexham, again, I'm not trying to diss Wrexham fans or take their magic.
Well, it sounds a little bit like it.
I know, it does a bit. It's because I'm jealous in it of Ryan Reynolds. But like, what I want to also acknowledge is that as a West Ham fan, I acknowledge that a ceremony is created around a third tier European competition, and yet the emotions feel real because there's so much investment that you put in it. It feels real while you do it.
Yep.
When Wimbledon get to the top flight, only to be evicted by the old peroxide Paxman over there, like, it's like it's a real story. But now it's almost like, you know, a sort of a construction. And my concern is this, is if it becomes, excuse me, a construction rather than a reality, it's going to lose the thing that it has in the first place, that it's not going to mean anything anymore. We're killing the golden goose, to put it in a simple phrase.
Again, I think you're being idealistic. How you get...
Of course I am. What else are you going to be?
Well, realistic is an alternative view, right?
You've got to bring them together.
Also,
reality is subjective.
A Venn diagram that we meet in the middle of.
That could be part of the branding of this series.
But it's still steeped in the values of Wrexham, isn't it? And it's still going through a system. It's still got to abide by the rules that come to pass in terms of governance and the way that it can spend money. It's just using its assets. So what we're saying is that Wrexham went through the gears by one methodology or another. And in this instance, it's got two Hollywood superstars that can use their digital imagery to leverage the revenues that you can get from digital spaces.
Yeah.
Like you guys are doing here, right? Yeah. And you build a club that goes there and lands in the Premier League. Would that be less of a story than constantly watch Manchester City win the league with Middle Eastern money, or Manchester United because it's steeped in 60 years of heritage and legacy and an ability to be able to print money for itself? Would it be less of a diminishing, or would it be diminishing the football story? Would it be devaluing it?
No, I think that would be a great contribution.
So what are you on about?
And of the two problems outlined there, I'd say that the Man City one is the greater one, particularly with them 115 charges.
So why do you keep attacking Wrexham then?
I'm not attacking Wrexham. I'm attacking the commodification of the sport in various ways and seeing if it's somehow stripping away its essence, hollowing it out.
But every time you stick something on television, including yourself, you're making it a commodity for someone else's benefit. You sit here doing your broadcast because a particular platform wants to give you an opportunity so they can monetize you. So you're a commodity. So you're quite happy with it. So why's your hypocrisy in?
Because there's such a thing called intention. It depends what's behind it. It depends what is the objective, what is the aim, what is the goal. If the aim is always and solely to make money, and remember, we've touched upon enlightened self-interest earlier in the conversation. Ideally, there's a kind of synthesis of, I have a purpose, I'm pursuing meaning, I'm earning a few quid out of it. That seems to me that's not in the same domain as stripping away the meaning of something that's sort of valuable, and I would argue even possibly sacred. And this is where I'm trying to get to. Is this the end of fairy tales in football? Could we ever have a little Wimbledon again? Could we ever have Leicester win the title?
Well, we just had it with Luton, haven't we? We've just had Luton, the ultimate fairy tale. Eric Morecambe, great comedian, I'm sure you appreciate, has indexed it. Luton many years ago, a club that was always punched above its weight, boom, collapses. Drops out of the league, gets put together by a fans group, have values like they won't attach himself to betting companies because they don't believe in the principle of betting money going into sport. And they've built a club that's now got promoted with 10,000 fans back into the Premier League. Are you worried that somewhere along the line they might change their agenda?
Are you suggesting that the criteria that you just outlined somehow makes it a worthwhile, valuable story? That the connection to the fans that espousing them values makes it better than a globalist corporate
I'm saying it's a mixed bag. You're sort of forecasting this dystopian future where football becomes something that is simply an end game for people with nefarious motives or alternative intentions. Everyone's got an intention. Very few people have got an intention simply to do it for the love of football, right? Everyone wants to get something from it. So with that in mind, I've just given you a case in point where Luton in our leagues have proven the point that there's still the value of football being built in a certain way for the people, from the people, because of the people, right?
Yeah.
And we don't lose the vibrancy of football by the nature of ownership models that might have different intentions. We muddy the messages sometimes, and we allow the broadcast world to fulfill their outcomes when we're constantly being listening to broadcasters pumping societal messages through football. You and I have discussed this on other platforms about the nature of football being leveraged for other people's agendas and how that should be or could be or would be or shouldn't be.
Yeah,
in my view, I think yours is the same.
The only agenda should be football.
I agree.
But I think you should be really critically alert to the various ways that agendas play out, including financially, including the agenda of state ownership of these football clubs.
But money makes the world go round, Russell.
It doesn't have to, though.
But it does.
It's a representative and symbolic system.
Don't you dare sit here and say you're doing this for charity or the things you've done in your life have been for charity. You do them because ultimately money is the commodity that fuels the world. So we all need to grow up a little bit.
The only word I would query there is the word ultimately, because we are not yet at the point of fully understanding the many miraculous ways that I express my intentions.
Well, definitively then. Maybe not ultimately.
No, not definitively, because like probably like you, I do what I do for a variety of reasons, but I began doing what I do out of love, bloody vanity. You know, I mean, there's a sort of a complex set of motivations, but at this point in my life, of course, I require,
I'm
as
idealistic.
You do,
I'm quite idealistic.
Fucking hell. I require a degree of financial security, but when I'm laying in bed at night, and let me tell you, it's a pretty sexy spectacle, I'm not thinking solely about my financial security. I'm thinking about a set of aims, a set of goals. How can we contribute to the conversation? The reason that I haven't got you
once
on here and banged on...
Once you've achieved your financial stability, so you start with this communistic approach, which is I'll look after myself first and then I'll build from there, and that's great, and that's there's nothing wrong with that.
We've all got to get our own mask on first. Of course we have. We have to sustain ourselves to
what we want in life is a degree of idealism meets realism, don't we? And a fair proportion of representation.
Now, where is this idealism going to be entering into the sport of football with the current trajectory?
But where's it been lost then? You keep suggesting it's been lost.
Because of the commercialisation, Simon, I suppose. I suppose that's what I'm...
Yeah, but you love to watch football dawn till dusk if you can. And watching sport for whichever medium you choose, whichever way you want to. Mm. And with that comes a commercial scenario because you're going to watch it through a medium that's commercially motivated. So with that in mind, how do you square that particular circle?
Well, we're arguing sort of a lot about economics. And I think in a sense, there's a great deal of validity in what you're saying. And there's no question.
Is there a reason why you've taken your shoes and socks off while we're debating?
I bothered, didn't I, a minute ago? And also, I was really thought, what I wanted to do.
Does it help your thinking?
I want to really concentrate.
Call your feet down and your head will start functioning.
It's a double-ended approach, Simon.
Okey-doke.
Get your little trotters out. Them tootsies under the table. Simon, no, this is what I want to say, is that those currently necessary commercial opportunities that are predicated on the emotion that football in particular solicits cannot be allowed to kill the host, which is currently what I fear
you think it is
could potentially happen. Yeah. So someone has to advocate for the idealistic side of the argument, which includes things like fan ownership, investigation, interrogation of ownership models, and assurances that these clubs will remain connected to the communities that built them, and ultimately the value of the fans will be respected.
That's what they're trying to achieve by the independent regulator suggestion in this country, which I think is for the birds, and I think any business, any industry that's regulated in the end isn't a particularly good industry to be in. And we have now reached a point, Russell, whether we like it or we don't like it, you and I, and again, I use the expression, I don't apologise for the genie's out of the bottle. We're not going to unwind this. We're not going to change the economic model. All we're going to be able to do is perhaps halt it in its tracks. But even then, we've now got Saudi Arabia wanting to pay footballers £200 million a year to go over there and play because they want to build their leagues up. So, again, I don't share your concerns. I understand why you think there's a validity in your thinking, that there's a loss of the core principles of the game and what they were supposed to be. But I'm not sure that when you see the emotion, when you watch Sheffield Wednesday, for those North American fans that don't know who they are, they're a club in Yorkshire that's got great heritage. When you watch Sheffield Wednesday play Peterborough in the League One semi-final with 32,000 rabid fans in a stadium and the emotions that outpour as a result of a game having a ridiculous outcome, do you then still worry about the fact that sport isn't valued in the way that it should be, isn't going in the right direction?
I think that they value it. And my fear is that it's that emotional connection has been parasited and that football means a lot about class, it means a lot about identity, it means a lot about geography, masculinity, unity, teamwork, and all of those things are very real and very beautiful. And I'd actually go so far as saying there's something sacred in it.
Okay, what do you mean football says a lot about class?
That these clubs have a historic and real relationship with the communities that they come from.
But we've got gentrification in every town now. So the fact that people...
That's not great either.
But that's the reality of economics, isn't it?
The reality of economics is a political matter. It's not like... It's not meteorology.
Gentrification
is not happening naturally. It's happening as a result of decisions, consensus, and a lack of democracy.
Well, gentrification is a good thing. If you were living in America in certain times during the scenarios where people were in red line districts, they would have cried out for gentrification, where that ultimately the income streams could have gotten bigger and people could have improved their own social standing. And so with that in mind, you're looking at a class structure of saying that football once upon a time was an old geezer with a rattle and a cloth cap going to the game. And the next generation of football supporters aren't cut from that particular cloth. Mm. We have a different generation following behind us.
Yes.
I'm not entirely sure that generation doesn't send me screaming to bed at night thinking they're looking after me in my dotage, but that's a different discussion. But the class argument, I think, is becoming less and less prevalent. Other parts of what you've just said might be relevant, but the fact that football is still steeped in a working-class mentality is probably not. Rugby and other sports may be, but we're not moving from football into cricket, where cricket has a certain attitude, or cricket into tennis. But there is a different social classification now of football fans.
I suppose what I'm encircling and analysing is, what is this value that football appears to herald? What is this secular ceremony that appears to be able to evoke such deep feeling and such deep connection?
It's like alchemy. I mean, if you could bottle it and sell it, you'd become a billionaire overnight.
They are bottling it and selling it, and that's part of the bloody problem.
But that provides access. So with the flip side of the coin is...
I bet if we change the subject, you'd still find me just as ravishing. Now, I bet if we change the subject to another commodity, that you would alter your perspective. Like if we started talking about, I don't know, entertainment or music or something, and I'm not going to. I want to talk about another aspect of football. But I feel that sometimes, because of your personal involvement with the sport, you find peculiarities that prevent you applying your ordinary principles to this matter.
Not at all.
And also, I think sometimes you're a contrarian, Simon.
The difference between you and me on the subject matter is I come from an educated point of view, and you're coming from a hypothetical, idealistic one where you don't know the nuts and bolts of it. You're looking at it from an idealistic point of view. I have both sides. I have the person that was a fan that bought a football club. I have the reality of the experience, and I look at it then from a slightly balanced point of view. I try to find balance.
That's the opposite of objectivity. That's a deepened subjectivity that's unable to consider a variety of perspectives and synthesize them. Yes. Now, the other thing that I want to talk about is like the power of leadership. I've seen you talk about it elsewhere on your excellent podcast Upfront. I loved your episode
with Sue
Ness.
Thank you very much.
I'm a pro, mate.
Yes.
The brilliant conversation with John Barnes was fantastic.
It's good, John, wasn't he?
When are you?
Very passionate,
excellent.
Very animated.
We've had him on here. He's masterful on the subject of class.
Did you read his
race
book called The Unconscious? The Unfortunate Truth About Racism.
I don't even read the books I write, let alone other people's. Now, like Simon, when I used to write for The Guardian, one of my mates noticed that I always ended up writing more about managers than any other aspect of the game. And I think that somehow in managers we find, obviously leadership, in some ways father figures. And I wonder if you'd talk for a while on what is the real observable, measurable power of a manager. Once The Athletic did this piece, right, where they said when you take out the super exceptional, the exceptions, your Cloughs, your Guardiolas, whatever, they said that results often aggregate out almost the same, regardless if you have this manager, that manager, or no manager at all. So what are we talking about when we say, like when we talk about greatness in managers? What are those qualities? What are those abilities? And who has it these days? And what is it when they lose it? What goes on when they have it for a bit, then lose it?
Well, I often have thought, having spent time with lots of managers and sometimes listened to these so-called Churchillian speeches that they give, and found myself deeply unaroused by the very nature of what they're saying. I don't mean sexually, I mean in terms of a response and a call to arms.
That's not the intention.
It's a little bit like The Emperor's New Clothes. I mean, there is players that can perform of their own volition. There's a situation where you have a player that can get to this level himself, right? Where you want to get him to here. So you're not managing from here to here, you're just managing from here to here. And that's where the managers step in. And this balance between leaders lead, Russell. You know, you can create better people, and you can create people that can operate at certain levels, but natural leaders have this ability to be able to communicate in such a fashion that inspires people to do things that they wouldn't ordinarily be prepared to do. And that means operating at a high level all the time, even when they don't feel like it. And the more you've got footballers being paid what I would consider to be F-off money, so they can end up telling people to F-off because they're in a situation where they can control their own destiny. One thing you control people through is finances. The other thing you can control people through is by motivating them, fear, cultures of excellence. But there's no one size fits all for managers. Guardiola, some people would say, could Guardiola manage Scarborough and get the same outcomes? I think probably he could, because I think he has the ability to be able to extract the very best from people by setting the highest standards, maintaining those standards, never deviating from those standards, and being across the subject matter, being deep in the detail, being a constant evolver, not standing still, not believing that what he knew yesterday is going to be prevalent for tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I think people like Guardiola are real exceptions. I think a lot of the football managers around, and I use this term and I throw it around quite regularly, and people don't particularly like it, but I think a lot of them are charlatans, get away with murder, and we do reward in sport too much mediocrity. Mm. There's too much of that going on. Mm. But I think managers are, they're not often, you know, the funny thing you will think is that these managers are the strongest people in the world, and often they're not. They have the same doubts and the same need for support as anyone else does. And there'll be people that say, who motivates the motivator? And that's where people like me, that own football clubs, come in and support managers. And there's a lot more of that going on than you would believe. A lot more of owners that will provide that prop. Because in football, there's this perverse reverse sentiment of success in life has many fathers. But in football, success is an orphan. It has one person that's responsible for it, whereas failure has many fathers. Mm. So if you're successful as a football team, it'll be the manager, no one else. It'll be the manager that created that success. But if you fail at football, it'll be bleeding everybody that did it. The manager's not, me, it's the players, it's the owner, it's the lack of support from the fan base. So there's that unique phenomenon. But it's just the ability to be able, like anything, if you're not doing it and someone else is doing it for you, it's that ability to be able to impart to them the desire for them to do what they need to do to be successful. It's like that again, to use a movie analogy, which I know you'll appreciate being a big movie star, it's like that scene out of The Untouchables where Sean Connery's talking to Kevin Costner about what are you prepared to do to get Capone. One of his guys brings a knife, one of your guys brings a gun, one of his guys goes to the hospital, one of your guys goes to the morgue. What are you prepared to do to get Capone? And I would say, what are you prepared to do to be successful? And to be a top-class manager, whatever it takes and whatever you need to do, whether that's managing up to the guy that you work for to get from him what you want, or it's managing down to the charges that you're responsible for, or whether it's selecting people that work with you that are actually better than you at certain things, and you have the comfort in your own space to be able to be the leader of those people, even though they're better. I remember having a finance director work for me in one of these businesses that I owned. And I said to him, you know, about doing something. He said, you do realize I'm a higher form of life. I'm a qualified professional. And I said, that's wonderful, but you fucking will work for me and I'm the managing director. So we'll debate about what's a higher form of life in a different discussion. But it's all about giving people a reason to want to be successful. And that may well just be by the very nature of the rewards that they get, or it might well be by the nature of the pride that you're invoking them, or the motivations that you give them to want to improve or keep changing the circumstances, or have basic disciplines that you will not move from. You will not change. Pep Guardiola will not change his view about how he wants a player to play. David De Gea will go in goal, make a mistake, and the next thing he'll do is no longer play out from the back. He'll be launching balls up from the front. Pep Guardiola would not accept that. He would make David De Gea perform at the level that he wanted to until such a time as he could. And if he couldn't, then he'd replace him. You have to be ruthless. You have to be fair. You have to be equitable. You have to be honest. You have to be authentic. You have to communicate with people. You don't duck responsibility. All of these things are the natural attributes of a leader. And there's not many of them about, because people don't like to deal with confrontation because that's part of it. They don't like to deal with being able to communicate in a way that sometimes means that you've got to find a balance between what you believe and what you need to say to somebody to get to where they need to get to. And it's all of these things in this sort of, again, alchemy that out of it comes a leader. Mm. And it's about leadership. When you walk in a room, you go, that's the leader. That's the guy. That's the guy we go with. That's the guy that we go over the trenches for. That's the guy that we want to play for. And even more, it's even more difficult in this day and age when you've got players like we've just discussed that are islands economically on their own. Mm. It takes away motivation.
I like what you described about there being a necessity for a vision and a refusal to compromise.
Yeah, drop your standards for
on
other people's
that vision. Mm. That's pretty exciting. Mm. And when you talk about being able to identify leaders, it's exciting to me that there ain't a uniform set of immediately identifiable external characteristics, that it could be someone that's relatively conservative, that's not always someone
leadership
that's mouthing
isn't
off or whatever.
An immutable concept. It morphs. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It's about what it, you know, a leader in one environment, because there's different tools required. If you're the elite manager at the top of the Premier League, you're managing guys that are all on £20 million a year. So you can't pull that trigger. You've got to pull a different lever. Yeah. So your skill set is no less or no more than, say, Neil Warnock, who managed for me in previous incarnations at Crystal Palace, managing further down the pyramid and achieving an outcome of relative success by getting a group of disparate sort of hobo footballers being able to perform at a very high level and then find themselves running through the pyramid.
Taking a relatively recent and localised example, how do you get a situation where Roy Hodgson is able to return to Palace for the umpteenth time and get more success out of Palace than Vieira, who to all intents would look like the very model of a new emergent manager that's going to succeed? And can you fold into that answer, because God knows you talk fucking long enough, how you get a moment where it looked like Arteta...
Am I getting paid by the word?
We can't afford you at that rate. If we pay by common sense,
I don't know
we can afford
you. How do you dare keep a straight face?
And what about, right, in it with the Hodgson Vieira one?
Yeah.
Could you fold in, like, you know, there was a minute where Arteta and Nunes were like neck and neck. It was like, which one of them's going to get sacked out of North London? And Arteta stays, and now he's the, you know, the next big thing.
No, Santos.
Excuse me. Yeah. So, like, you know, so like, what is that thing that's sort of like unquantifiable about it? How do you track it? How do you get Hodgson come in and revitalise Palace in such a in that way?
I think it's just sometimes it's nothing more simple than timing. I think there with the Vieira situation, I think there was a dissatisfaction with certain coaching methods of the players to stop listening, if you want to be specific and explicit about Vieira. And there was a lot more of the emperor's new clothes in that appointment. It looked good for a period of time. And when the reality of it comes more prevalent and the players start to go, And Roy comes back in, he's comfortable. He says sensible things. He does sensible things with players. And he had a better squad of players than the one he left. The reasons why Roy Hodgson left Palace is because it needed to evolve. And the brand of football had gotten a little bit boring. Now, it's like night and day currently. Roy Hodgson's version of Crystal Palace this time round, version two, is a completely different Palace side, attacking and forward-thinking and
ambitious.
Has
he done that?
Because I don't think he's had the same challenges as he had once before. When he was at Palace, he was there to make sure that Crystal Palace achieved the constant pursuit of staying in the Premier League with a season in front of him. This time round, he was coming in to fix someone else's mess with a group of players that needed a different voice, and he just let them go, pointed them in the right direction and let them go. Sometimes less is more. Mm. And in the situation that you use of Arteta and Nuno Espirito Santos, they were just... The Tottenham appointment by Daniel Levy, who's someone I get on quite well with, it's a surprise that we do, because we had nothing but confrontation when I was involved in football, because he was constantly trying to do things to my football club that I didn't appreciate. But over the years, I've seen both sides of the argument and I can appreciate some of the things he does. But his appointment with Nuno Espirito Santos was just a bad appointment. Arteta was a moment in time. He'd lost his way and he'd moved from somebody I thought had the chops to do something to somebody that was all theory. And he was falling in between two stools. He didn't know whether he was Arthur or Martha. Didn't know he was having a shit or a haircut. And he got lucky by beating Norwich in a game, and all of a sudden the world changed again. And then he got some balls, and then he got rid of Aubameyang and said to the dressing room, here I am. Then All or Nothing comes along and everyone starts to get a different point of view, a TV show, and he's off again. And some of it can just be, you know, you've been successful and unsuccessful in life at times, more successful than unsuccessful. And I've had a combination of both, and again, more successful than unsuccessful. But there's sliding door moments. And sometimes it's got nothing to do with how good you are. It's just, you know, it's just a moment in time. I lose £50 million in a football club because a player that I bought from my academy in a playoff semi-final hits the post on a penalty. changes the direction of travel for me. I go and do some deals that eventually cause me a lot of problems. The same player pops up 2 years later, Ben Watson, God love him, come out of my academy, and scores the winning goal in an FA Cup final for Wigan. And these moments in time that sport throws out that takes you back to the sentiment we started with.
That's a beautiful way to begin to wrap this up. As you know, I'm a big fan of your show with Jim White over on TalkSport. I love coming on there as a guest.
Yeah, we love having you on there.
Yeah, I really like
him
there.
Gangly.
No, come on, mate. I want to do this thing. Oh, God, look, we're late, look.
Don't do this, right, because I had all this bullshit from Martin Keown, what you're about to do here.
Martin Keown?
Bring in a word
you're
of the week.
You're saying that I'm suggesting that item that you rejected from Martin Keown?
I didn't want it from Martin Keown. I didn't want a word of the week.
What's next? That Steve Bould came up with my argument that corporatisation has a bigger influence than player wages.
Yeah, Dean Windass brought it forward. God love you, Dean. He's from Hull. I know one of your producers from Hull.
Oh, yeah, no. And yes. Dean Windass is his favourite player, as a matter of fact.
I like Dean. And his son, Josh, has done wonderfully well for Sheffield Wednesday.
What he said, what Keown said, right, let's try and get these superannuated, I've heard you use.
Yes.
A posteriori, fatuous, I've heard you use that. Sophistry, you could drop that in. There were some of the ones I'd really
you
like.
You used that the other day, sophistry.
Yeah, I did. I've been reading my words thing. I don't share these with many people. These are my favourite words.
Is that because nobody wants to hear them?
I've got a lot of pushback.
Am I the victim of this one?
But while you're here, the door's locked. You'll sit and listen. One I would like to hear on Talk Sport, and then what I would rather like was because I watch most of your stuff on YouTube, right? You know, that's when I watch your clips. Jordan and White striding forward in their trousers in this.
The Colosseum of Confrontation. I don't like that, you know. That moniker that they give it, the Colosseum of Confrontation, it makes you look like a one-trick pony. I would prefer the Colosseum of Common Sense. Things of that nature.
It's not a...
Not this adversarial position.
Here, this is good. Constural understanding or perception. That's an interesting constural, could say to Jim. That would be good. You could say reify. Look, I'm not going to sit here and reify Mikel Arteta. Apotropaic, I mentioned that to you when I was in there. Apotropaic, that means good luck charm.
Yes.
Could you please just get apotropaic in tomorrow, yep, and then we'll use that clip. It'll be good promo for this. You can listen, if you can bear it, to Simon every weekday on TalkSport.
That's not much of a plug.
If you've got the guts, if you've got the stomach, you can listen to Simon Jordan every weekday on TalkSport or on YouTube, you know, before he gets banned in the UK from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. BST. On the show next week, we've got Jack Dorsey coming on. There he is. Look, join our locals community. Just press the red button and you can join us for exclusive interviews, meditations, podcasts and all sorts of fantastic stuff. My stand-up special, Brandemic, is premiering this Sunday on Moment. Pre-order your tickets now at moment.co/Russell Brand. Join us next week, not for more of the same, but for more of the different. Until then, thank you, Simon Jordan.
Pleasure. Nice to be here.
Until next time, because surely there will be a next time. There's so much more to cover.
Because I want to come back and learn some more words.
Not just words, how to construct an argument, Simon.
Indeed.
How to open your mind. Yes. How to stay loyal to your roots. Yes. How to use your power to galvanise a new movement.
How to listen to platitudes.
They're not platitudes. These are the roaring anthems of a new and emergent movement. A bowel movement. Until next time, stay free.